Well, good morning. Thank you all for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project with Karen Von Hippel. And it's always a pleasure for us to have another program on Afghanistan. We've, as I recognize many of the faces here, we've really had an ongoing series, and due in large part to the help and collaboration of Hekmat, our guest speaker here today. Well, he was the first secretary at the embassy. He was most helpful in bringing a series of distinguished guests, and now he's having a chance to enter the honor roll himself. So it's great to have him here. Basically, what you all have his biography in front of you, and so, but I'd just like to say that in the last in recent days, Hekmat has authored a paper called "The Return of the Black Turban: Causes of the Taliban Insurgency," and I know that many of you, if you haven't had a chance to read it, some of that will be picked up in his comments today. We'll be obviously having the usual 30-35 minute presentation, and then spending the last part of the hour on your questions in an informal discussion. And so, Hekmat, it's great to have you here. Welcome, and we're looking forward to your remarks.
It's a lot of money. Thank you, Rick, for those warm remarks. At the outset, let me extend my gratitude to CSIS for hosting this event, especially Morgan Courtney, who has been instrumental in facilitating this event. I remember calling her from Afghanistan at very odd hours and waking her up. So my condolences and apologies for that. Thank you for coming. I'm delighted to be back in Washington, a place where I've spent quite a number of years, both rewarding and challenging. Looking back at it, my days spent lobbying on both sides of the hill, figuring out, you know, the budget cycle in the United States, and especially the intricate bureaucracies of Washington, and looking at my job now as a terrorism analyst, and in certain cases, which requires me to go to areas like Uruzgan, Zabul, which might be considered the hotbed of Taliban, I seem to think my current job is much easier. So, as Rick mentioned, my presentation is sort of culmination of this project that I've been working on, and I will try to discuss three elements in my presentation. First, I'll try to briefly discuss the global threat and how it has changed, and then specifically how this change has affected Afghanistan and vis-a-vis the Taliban. And lastly, how do we deal with the terrorism and specifically the Taliban insurgencies that has emerged in Afghanistan? I think if we look at the landscape of terrorism, it's undeniably clear that it's characterized by change. And change, like in all things, happens in two dimensions, the good and the bad. There's the positive and the negative elements. The positive, I think, is that the United States has destroyed al-Qaeda's infrastructure in Afghanistan. The terrorist Disneyland that once existed in Afghanistan is destroyed. 75% of al-Qaeda's leadership has been killed or captured. Individuals like Abu Hafs, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and many of the leadership of al-Qaeda has been killed or captured. The United States, with the assistance of its partners, has captured over 4,000 Salafist jihadist leaders. And these are all positive elements of the global war on terror, or whether you call it this struggle against violent extremism. However, with all positive, I think a negative element also has emerged. The negative element is that the enemy has changed, and the enemy has changed tremendously. It's more adaptable, more resilient. And when we say al-Qaeda, the operational organization, very clearly has diminished in sizes and numbers, but Al-Qaeda, the global jihad, has found a wide resonance among the radical Muslims. And how I want to prove this is, if we look at the attacks before 9/11, we see major attacks first. We have the East Africa bombing in 98, then 2000 Cole, and then 2001 September 11. And each of these attacks took about 2 to 5 years in terms of tactical and planning operations. But since that, what we have seen is that there's attacks almost every other month. There's Morocco, Riyadh, Islamabad, Bali, London, and Bali again. So the question is, who's responsible for these attacks? And I categorize this in terms of three threats. I think the threat in certain ways is clearly more diffused, but at the same time, we have to look at it in a sort of layers. First, there's the Al-Qaeda leadership, which I call the core or the Al-Qaeda motivational group. This is Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Conventional wisdom would tell us that they're somewhere between the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they continue to provide motivation, even though in certain ways trying to plan attacks. But I think they're not more of a, in my regard, strategic operational threat. They are a strategic threat because they're constantly providing motivation. Just since 9/11, Osama bin Laden and his number two has produced over around 40 different audio and videotapes. They serve an amazing inspiration. So that is the first layer. The second layer is the Al-Qaeda network. These are independent cells that do not take command or has any affiliations with Al-Qaeda. But very clearly, they're motivated by what Al-Qaeda has become or what has happened. And these groups are very clearly what we see, these new phenomena in Madrid, especially in London, and even the groups now that are in Iraq. And this, in certain ways, is a very scary trend, especially when it comes to Europe. And the last element is Al-Qaeda affiliates. This are mostly groups that are like-minded and have trained with Al-Qaeda. First, during the Russian invasion from 1979 to 1989, and then upon the Russian withdrawal, Osama bin Laden comes to Afghanistan in 96 when he's kicked out of Sudan. And many of the groups come back. It's estimated that groups from 43 different came back. These are groups like the South Asian groups, like JI, more Islamic Liberation Front, and even African groups, Middle Eastern groups. I have put Taliban in this category, and I will go into it as to why I think they are now, why they have joined the global ideological jihad. I'll discuss this in greater detail. But I think one of the main reasons why a lot of these groups have joined the struggle is that because I think 9/11 had a tremendous impact on a lot of these groups. Not only a lot of these groups, but I think it had a huge impact on bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11. I think two of the main principles of why 9/11 was carried out, I think the first one was bin Laden really believed if he attacked the United States in its most iconic places, the United States would abandon the Arabian Peninsula. And he gives constant examples of this in his literature. He refers to Vietnam, he refers to Beirut, he refers to Somalia. In many cases, he refers to the United States as the paper tiger, that they cannot take this pain. So what we saw was that the first expectation was proven wrong because Osama bin Laden and his group of minions were attacked by the United States, Operation Enduring Freedom. The second expectation, in my opinion, was that if Osama bin Laden believed that if he was to be successful carrying these attacks, I think he would become the vanguard of the Muslim Ummah, not just a leader, you know, that, look, he has carried this attacks and he would have this following. And unfortunately, that has become a reality. A lot of these groups are mounting attacks. They're carrying out attacks the way Al-Qaeda carries out attacks. One example of this would be JI, Jamaat Islamiya in South Asia, is that if we look at their characteristics before 9/11, is that they were very much concentrated on their own local agenda. But after 9/11, the target trajectory shifted. They started to attack what bin Laden refers to as the head of the poisonous snake, attacking Western targets and allies of the West. They have attacked, especially in Bali again, the Marriott in Jakarta, and the Australian embassies. These are all Western targets. But why I put Taliban in this category is because during my research, I have come across a lot of elements that I think the entity that we knew Taliban at one point was as a conservative entity, especially even in their outlook and their strategy, I don't think it's that outlook anymore. I think it has shifted. And I will try to go into a brief detail. If we look at the concept or the phenomenon of Taliban by itself, I don't think it's a new phenomenon. Talibs and mullahs have played a role in Afghanistan's history, going all the way to the second and third Anglo-Afghan wars. If you look at Afghan literature, you see many accounts of many mullahs and talibs inflicting heavy casualties on the British. There's an account of Mullah Shor Bazar, who has inflicted many casualties in the third Afghan-Anglo war in 1919. But the emergence came in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, when calls for defensive jihads were raised against individuals like Sheikh Abdullah Azam and even the various groups, the Afghan leaders, and Taliban that at one point that were studying at the various madrasas and even at mosques started to participate in the jihad. They started to join the various groups, but they joined two particular groups, and they fought for a decade against the Russians in a very brutal war in which over 1 million Afghans were killed, a quarter of the population became refugees. Social indicators, I think, are at its worst. But upon of the Russian withdrawal in February of 89, the Taliban's in certain aspects go back to, you know, either some of them, their madrasas, and continue their studies. However, many of us know what Afghanistan went through. Many Western experts believe that when the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, Afghanistan lost its geostrategic position or its geostrategic importance. Even when the communist government was in place in Afghanistan, even after their downfall, peace was not something that came to Afghanistan. There was this constant struggle between the local individuals. And the conditions really deteriorated. Most of us knew that. And to even travel from one part of Afghanistan to the other became almost impossible. There were four different currencies all throughout Afghanistan. And a wonderful and charming new vocabulary came to the Afghan dictionary. Words like warlords were introduced. And these warlords really controlled particular segments and parts of Afghanistan. And there's a very strong belief that the Taliban emergence was because of this disillusionment with a lot of these groups, because they weren't able to bring peace to Afghanistan. While there are many speculations on their emergence, but it's very clear that within a very short period of time, a group of students brought unchallenging security to the south. They restored security in the southern parts of Afghanistan and even killed several of these warlords in the south. And on many occasions, Afghans that I interviewed during my research, many of them supported. There were even talks in certain circles that they were going to bring the former king, you know, and restore the monarchy. So not only Afghans, but I think Afghan intellectuals started to support them because they seemed like a viable alternative at the time, as a military alternative. So the question was, why did they support them? Because they really had very sort of attractive objectives at that stage where people were really suffering. They were saying, look, we're going to put an end to this conflict. We're going to disarm the people. And I've come up on these objectives by looking at the various interviews, and I've done my own interviews with people. I looked at hundreds of literature pieces that I've come across, and these I found to be their initial objectives in the early phases. So with power and popularity came, obviously, support. And very clearly, we see the first element that came to its support as a movement was Afghanistan's neighbor, Pakistan. Nasrullah Babur, the interior minister of Pakistan, needed guarantees, and they were desperate to start trade with the newly independent states in the north, and they found these guarantees in Taliban. While some of their other institutions were banking on other elements of the war, like Gulbuddin, but Nasrullah Babur eventually changed those elements and had the whole security apparatus behind the Taliban. In terms of recruitment, the Taliban did not only recruit from local madrasas. I think they recruited heavily from the Pakistani madrasas, especially individuals like Maulana Fazlur Rahman, who was the head of Jamiat-e-Islami. They brought tremendous amount of resources, thousands and thousands of supporters. The resources came from, obviously, the drug trade and even local businessmen that tried to support them. So they became a military force within Afghanistan. But they did, however, face opposition. Not everybody supported them. They had two fronts that they were constantly battling on the west and in the north. 1996, however, a new development occurs. The international pressure, especially led by the United States, forces Sudan to kick Osama bin Laden out of that country, and Osama bin Laden comes back to Afghanistan. And immediately upon his arrival, Mullah Omar welcomes him and offers him a place in Kandahar, and an alarming marriage of convenience is formed. This marriage of convenience has led to many things. First, various training camps are established. These various training camps are not only camps where foreign fighters were trained, but at the same time, for the first time, we see Taliban training camps. Taliban established their own training camps all through even Jalalabad and even in Kandahar. There were many training camps where Taliban were not only indoctrinated, but they were trained in a very sophisticated way. And I think a lot of their initial objectives that they had come up with, a lot of the individuals in certain way that if we can even call them moderates, tended to, you know, were pushed away from even the leadership role. And I think the goals and objectives in many ways shifted. And what we see is a very draconian measures. The actions that they took were despicable. They were not what Afghans really would associate themselves with. Some of these things, like closing the schools and even banning elements of Afghan culture, became paramount. And even there was religious police that enforced these edicts fervently. And their last draw, I think, was the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas. And I think it was not only a crime, I think, against the Afghans, but I think it was a crime against humanity, because I think the Bamiyan Buddhas did not belong to Afghanistan. It belonged to the civilizations. And destroying that literally alienated them from all of the population and everybody inside Afghanistan. Change of faith, September 11 occurs, and that is the end of Taliban as a military institute and a political entity. And within a month, October 7th, United States starts Operation Enduring Freedom, and the terrorist universities and the command and control that Afghanistan where Taliban, which had command and control, was destroyed. And we see the start of a political process in Afghanistan through the Bonn Conference, where four of the major groups came and formed the interim administration. And since then, I think there have been tremendous progress in certain cases in Afghanistan. We see that refugees have come back, schools have opened, there have been presidential and parliamentary elections, parliamentary election in which there was 26% women were elected in that. So these are all positive steps. However, security remains a major consideration, and Taliban continue to regroup. And just this year, over 1,400 individuals, including NGO workers, religious leaders, and even government civil servants have been killed. So what accounts for this recent insurgence in violence? That is the thesis that I worked with. And doing my research, I came upon several factors. And factor one is that Taliban have adopted a new lethal strategy. This strategy has several elements, including military and media tactics. First, after the initial setback of September 11, the Taliban entity realized that they could not face the U.S. government or the U.S. military institutions in force on force. So they retracted to this strategic defensive position, and they started to attack soft targets. They attacked soft targets for the fact that they wanted to install fear in the population. But at the same time, they had many other objectives during this time. This was first to alienate the population from the aid community. During this time, we see many of the international organizations like Doctors Without Borders that are prominent organizations left Afghanistan. They not only left Afghanistan, but it deprived a specific segment of the population from aid and resources that were desperately needed. So no significant change came to the lives of those people. So that was one very strategic element. But during this time, Taliban started to gather support not only from the narcotics. Foreign fighters started to emerge back. Individuals that were not able to go to Iraq started to come back to Afghanistan. There were Chechens, there were Arabs, and old relationships rekindled, old relationships with neighbors and various institutions that at one point supported them, they rekindled. And there are several reports that I came upon that said that there were various Taliban members that went to Iraq and trained with the insurgents, and insurgents from Iraq has come to Afghanistan and have trained many of the Taliban leaders. And we see a tremendous sophistication in what Taliban used to be and what they are now. There have been many cases of beheadings. This is documented. Improvised explosive devices, very sophisticated. You can hardly tell. You can hardly find the pieces of bombs. And a new arsenal has been introduced into the war, suicide bombing. Most of you who are observant of the Afghan history, this is a new element. This is not something Afghans are used to. And many of the Afghans that I still interviewed say that, look, these are Arabs. You know, Afghans, this is not in our culture. But this may be something that Afghans could be adapting to. And before the Taliban spokesperson, Mullah Hakimi, was arrested, he gave a statement that there are 45 more suicide bombers waiting to explode themselves for jihad. But the Afghans kept telling me in certain ways, even when I interviewed them, that, look, these are not Afghans, the people that are blowing themselves up. And there's certain literature that supports this fact in certain ways, because the last suicide attacker that blew himself up in Kabul, there were reports that he was a Yemeni. But there are other accounts for suicide attacks that have taken place that could prove that these are actually Afghans. Besides military strategy, I think there's a very sophisticated military strategy, there's a media strategy that Taliban have adopted. Unlike the Taliban that we knew that used Shabnameh or the light night letters or just, you know, just radios, the Taliban have gone on the information superhighway. They have joined the internet. They're posting magazines. And very recently, they have started to post videos. Videos that are as sophisticated as the ones that are coming out of Iraq. And there's one particular series called The War of the Oppressed that have several series. And you see these attacks at a very sophisticated pace. And you see these attacks that are happening. The operation that was carried out in Konar, in which a Chinook was brought down and then a Navy SEAL was killed. All of this is filmed and it's online. And so this media strategy is very prominent, I think, to their overall strategy, because this is a way for them to influence the population. And I think many of them have obviously carrying on this whole bandwagon of the clash of civilization, and this is the element that they're using in certain ways to look at the people to start, you know, supporting this jihad, you know, that it is actually a jihad, because these people are, especially referring to the Westerns and the foreign occupations, they're not considering us as their equals. Look, they just want to come and exploit us. So there are a lot of elements that have been used. The second factor that I looked at and that I think is instrumental is the Afghan institutional capacity. The Afghan National Army and the police force, especially the army that we saw was dissolved in the 90s by the various commanders. And it is just now in the process of establishing itself. The U.S. is building an Afghan National Army, and there has been so far about 27 to 28,000 individuals in the National Army. I think in certain ways it has progressed well. The police force, in certain ways, there's a five-week course that they take. I mean, then there's a very advanced level course to 9 weeks. So I think they're very much in their earlier stages. They will very much need their experience in terms of dealing with this threat. And the intelligence directorate that I looked at, there were some elements that I really offer suggestions on. And one of the key elements is that when we look at Afghan intelligence, especially in regards to Khar, it was trained initially by the KGB in the 70s, early 70s, and late 60s. And I think their mandate in certain regards was to spy on local opposition, on local political activists, and look at the internal threat. But what I think needs to happen is this psychological shift in the intelligence apparatus is for them to look at the threats outside, where the threat is emanating from. That, I think, is the key element within the intelligence sector that I think needs to take place. And I think so far there has been some positive developments. There has been reform that is taking place. But I think they will still need time in order to deal with the threat in an efficient manner. The third factor is, I think, the most serious one. It's very clear, any student of counterinsurgency, of terrorism, will tell you that there's no basic recipe of dealing with terrorism. But one thing they will tell you, that there are basic principles that one must be able to deal with, one must be able to address for you to deal with counterinsurgency or terrorism. And one of the most important principles, in my opinion, and even others, is that you have to know the environment that you're operating in. You have to know the culture. You have to know the people that you're dealing with. Afghanistan is not Switzerland. Afghanistan is not the Middle East. Afghanistan has unique history. Afghanistan has unique culture and unique religion. And Afghans see themselves very different compared to others. This, in my opinion, has not been respected at all. Unfortunately, I have been very critical at this point, because I think I do want this struggle or this fight to succeed in Afghanistan. And the individuals that I interviewed, there's been about 4,000 to 5,000 individuals that have been killed. They were innocent civilians. And I don't need to remind individuals that what happens in a war, in a tribal or a cultural society, when you kill one person, you're not alienating only their one person or their house and their family. You're alienating a community and you're alienating a tribe. The recent events that have taken place, especially with burning of the bodies, in my opinion, there's absolutely no explanation for acts like that. How could you even explain them to the Afghans? In one of my events, I was talking to some elders, and we were discussing the U.S. operations, and they had their doubts about what the U.S. was here for. And I said, look, they come here with very good intentions. They want to help us. And they have, you know, they want to support what's happening in Afghanistan. And he said, Mr. Karzai, look, thank you for all this, but look, I would like to ask you this one question about the U.S. And I said, sure. And he said, the U.S. keeps telling us that a lot of these acts that are taking place, a lot of these despicable acts, whether it's, you know, desecration of the Quran, whether it's burning, you know, the bodies, whether it's, you know, Abu Ghraib and all that, and they keep saying that it's individual acts. If these are individual acts, then why on earth are they keep happening over and over again? And with acts like these, we might have good intentions, but we're really, really losing the goodwill of the Afghan people. And this is the worst thing that can happen, because dealing with insurgency, as Mao has said, is the population is fish in the water, and it's the population that really matters. And unfortunately, we have not engaged the population. Why were we so successful in the early stages of 9/11? Because the population was on our side. And now we have, in certain ways, abandoned them. So if we really want to be successful, we have to build bridges with these communities, communities that lay around those areas, communities that do not have resources, communities that are desperate, and they want to engage in a dialogue. But the only time soldiers go there is when they're looking for Taliban, or when they're bombing them. So this was one of the elements that I criticized and talked about. Factor four that I looked at was the global struggle, the global Muslim struggle. And I think whether we call it, you know, the globalization effect, whatever happens in the rest of the world, Afghans are discussing it the next day. And events that are happening has a huge impact on the psyche of the Afghans. Slow pace of reconstruction is also an element that was discussed. And there seems to be this idea that Kabul is Afghanistan and Afghanistan is Kabul. This is a very wrong notion. Afghanistan has 34 provinces, hundreds of districts, and we did not really should not assume that the capital is Afghanistan. The NGO community needs to go out to the areas that are really desperate, that are poor. And there's this debate of whether what comes first. Is it security or is it reconstruction? Which comes first? Do they go parallel? But the NGO community believes that there needs to be security before we can go there. Role of outside actors, I think, is very key, especially Pakistan. I have looked at and interviewed several Pakistani officials, and I think there has been recent sort of finger pointings on both sides in terms of the evolutions that have taken place. But I think, in my opinion, both countries really need to work on relationship that enhances their security cooperation in terms of transfer of knowledge and understanding. Because I think Pakistan cannot really do without a stable Afghanistan and vice versa. And this is a fact that should be understood. And I think policies like strategic depth and open hand should be disregarded. And there truly is a bright future in the region, but I think with positive policies. Now, to my humble recommendations. Dealing with just insurgencies, I think there has never been, in my opinion, and many others would tell you, there has never been a military solution to dealing with terrorism or insurgency. You look at the great Frank Kitson, who has written some of the best book on insurgency. He says, look, dealing with low-intensity operations, we have to use political, social, economic, and military measures. So I think some of this principle exactly applies to Afghanistan. So two sets of recommendations, obviously political recommendation and military. Political recommendation is that I think Tahkim al-Sulh, which is the reconciliation process in Afghanistan, has to be further utilized. Some of the Taliban that I spoke with, I said, look, why didn't you come back after 9/11? You know, why didn't you join the government? They said, well, we were told that if we came back, we would be sent to Guantanamo. And I said, weren't you aware that, look, you could come back and, you know? And they said, no, we did not know. So another thing is that foreign soldiers have to be culturally educated, not only in terms of this laser-guided missiles and network-centric warfare, all this. It might matter in a conventional war, but we're not fighting a conventional war. This is an asymmetric warfare where the other side knows that this is the way to beat you. They have waged a war of attrition, and they believe that they're constantly bleeding you, not only in financial resources, but in human sources. So I think in my reports, I've gone into detail in a lot of these other recommendations. Military recommendations. Heavy-handed approach has to stop. It only leads to blowbacks and consequences, no matter how accurate your laser-guided missiles are. And when it kills one innocent person, it kills a whole community. You have to be really cautious of this. Last is the strategy, the broader strategy. I think if we look at, you know, the global war on terror, what exactly does it mean? You know, declaring a war an abstract noun, or does it have other elements in terms of policy? And I think in certain ways the United States has realized that, and I think they have moved forward with this struggle against violent extremism. I do think it's a useful phrase, but what exactly does it mean? Is it a strategy that looks at root causes? Is it a strategy that only deals with symptoms? Is it a strategy that deals with specifically recruitment? And most importantly, is it a strategy that is looking forward? That's it. Thank you very much.
While you're getting your questions ready, and I'd like, when you do ask your question, if you just could introduce yourself and tell us where your affiliation, and limit your question to less than a minute, that would be very helpful, because I'm sure there are going to be many, many questions. Before I call on you, I'd just like to make a couple announcements. If there are some extra seats, if you would like to sit down, or if you had enough exercise already, please join us in the seats all over the room. Feel free to walk across and find them. Secondly, we really want to thank our co-sponsors for this event, the Project on Terrorism. I know has been very much involved with this. And thank here at CSIS, and also our funders, the International Organization for Migration, really made much of our work in Afghanistan possible. I'm sure some of you have seen our report in The Balance, which is on the web and will be in its published form in about 2 to 3 weeks, and I hope you'll get a chance to look at it. It has been somewhat updated even from the copy that's on the internet. And also the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which is one of our core funders and has allowed us to do a whole range of our work. I think that those are the key announcements that I needed to make. Let's move to your questions and comments. And we have a microphone here, although this is a small room. I think it'll be helpful if you could use it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Karzai. Question, of course, on the narcotics.
Can you tell us who you are, please?
Oh, sorry. David Isby, Spot Incorporated. Question on the narcotics issue. While you mentioned that, and, of course, continued involvement by former Taliban as well as non-Taliban in the cultivation and trafficking, this has been suggested as being a very large security issue, and that there are other people who are neither Taliban nor non-Taliban profiting from it. How do you see the importance of the narcotics threat as being to the security of Afghanistan, and what do you suggest in dealing with it?
Thank you. Dealing with narcotics, I think especially, we cannot look at the security sector and deal with it specifically in individual bases. I think you have to look at the Taliban, the security, narcotics, and even the specific warlords. You have to address them in a circle. They both feed off one another. They both support one another. In terms of policy so far with narcotics, I think there were several mistakes that have been made in terms of dealing with or coming up with the concise policies, especially in the early 2002. I remember the British had a policy of paying the farmers, which actually had a blowback. So we went from, you know, 4 to 5 provinces to 15 provinces. You know, the farmers thought that, well, we will pay, they're going to pay us. So either they come and destroy the crop or we just sell it in the market. Another element was that the United States did not take narcotics very seriously because they had their own issues with Colombia. And it has been very recently that I think the United States Congress and the executive branch got together and supported a big funding. I think there's around $780 million that have been allocated for that. And I think that has had a very positive element, have added a positive element to the overall policy. If we look at DEA's efforts in Afghanistan, I think they have been very successful. Afghanistan themselves have taken several initiatives, including creating a Ministry of Counter Narcotics that I think has been productive. But I think one element that has not been utilized in this battle is that we need to go back to the roots of Afghanistan. We need to utilize the cultural element. What works in one country may not work in another country. A lot of people have suggested that we need to deal with stiffer legislation and all these things. But I think the key element is mobilizing the Afghan population. And I keep coming to this point, is there's a very strong fabric within society that, you know, which holds the society together in Afghanistan. And within all these years, I still find it there. And I think those are the networks, those informal channels that I think needs to be utilized. Whether it's tribal leaders, whether it's the religious leaders, those are the individuals that we need to associate with. So, thank you.
Let me just do about 3 questions together here, because we've got several. That's okay.
Thank you.
Well, you can back them up. Are you comfortable with that?
Take 2.
That's okay, 2 at a time.
Hello. Amin Tazi from RFERL. You mentioned, welcome back, you mentioned the issue of reconciliation and bringing the Taliban back into the fold. And there was a major effort specifically before the elections to give them a chance. And as you know, 6 major Taliban, including the former foreign minister and former deputy minister of virtue and vice, which you mentioned, ran, and they didn't even get 1%, especially I'm talking about Mutawakkil and Kandahar and Khalsal and Logar, although 2 of them won, one in Samangan and one. And what you think is the reaction specifically in their birthplace in Kandahar, why Mutawakkil, who was a soft Talib, if you would say, and did reconciliation, was released by the United States, rehabilitated by the Afghan government, did so poorly? Thank you.
Why was he not elected? I think there are many elements. One particular is, I think there's a lot of tribal issues that I think would not allow him to elect. I think there are specific tribes that have specifically elected specific individuals, and they just weren't going to support him. And in another regard, the Afghan population do not have a positive memory from the Taliban, in my opinion, because if you look at the harsh realities they inflicted on the Afghans, some of them still remains in the Afghan psyche. And even though I think there are certain elements, you know, that I think we can deal with, but I think in certain ways I did not see them in the political process, because there was still this element that did not allow them, you know. I mean, in certain areas they did vote it for, like Rakati got elected in Zabul and in other areas, but yeah, in other areas, I think they just did not have the support. In my opinion, I think the people that we really need to cater is to the foot-level soldiers. Those are the people that we need to get on the ground. Those are the people that I think we need to get in the political process, because the commanders and all that, individuals like Mullah Dadullah, you know, I don't think he really cares about the reconciliation process. whatever you throw before them, you know, he doesn't really care. But one of the main reasons why I'm saying that this reconciliation could be further utilized is to bring the lower level Taliban, the individuals that may not be responsible for, you know, the brutalities that were able, you know, that just joined because they were forced in certain ways. It was very clear by 1999 and even in 98, many people did not want to join the Taliban. They even sent out their sons outside the country, but they were still forced. So there were several elements why they weren't elected, but, you know, so thank you.
Okay, back corner. We'll go with the microphone.
Hi, I'm Bei Fong with U.S. News and World Report. I just came back from covering the parliamentary election in Afghanistan, and I'm just wondering, sort of a follow-on to Amin's question, do you think the inclusion of the Taliban in the political sphere, both in terms of allowing them to run for parliament and in terms of expanding the reconciliation program, has actually had much of an effect on the insurgency? Because as you said, you know, in the past 6 months, this year, there has been this resurgence. Is there some sort of disconnect between the people that the government is reaching out to and the people who are actually running this insurgency?
Yeah. I don't think there is one element that is specifically adding, contributing, or taking away from the insurgency. I think there are several elements that have contributed. And I think dealing with it, we should not really look at one specific mechanism. Several initiatives have to be adopted, whether it's on the military front or on the political front. Like I said, if we keep using military tactics, we'll only make the insurgency worse. But if we use political measures, I think we can incorporate them. I think we can bring them to the table. In certain ways, there is disconnect because I don't think we're communicating. I don't think we're communicating with the communities. I don't think we're communicating with people that are listening and have started to found, you know, more respect for the Taliban. We're not communicating with them. We're abandoning them in certain ways. So their support is obviously coming from, you know, the population in certain ways, from both sides of the borders. So it's engaging those people that I think are the key element. Thank you.
We'll get to you next.
Shanti D'Souza, visiting scholar at SAIS. You mentioned the three layers, and you mentioned Taliban as an affiliate to the Al-Qaeda. But you know that during from the time Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan, both these movements merged into a symbiotic relationship, and there was a convergence at the leadership level as well. So how do you put Taliban as an affiliate to the Al-Qaeda while dealing with the whole phenomena itself? And the second question is about Khad and the agents, the intelligence there. What happened to this Khad after Najibullah, and are they still around there in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Sure. I think it's undeniable. I don't think you can deny the impact of Al-Qaeda on Taliban. I think if you look at their radicalization, I think if you look at their initial objectives, I think it's very clear that there was massive, massive indoctrination. Even though there were many other groups that came from the outside that were infected with, I think, three things. One, a lot of these groups that came were first radicalized in terms of their ideology. They went from having a local agenda to a globalized agenda. Second, they were trained in tactics, and they were trained in terms of dealing, you know, with the insurgencies and how to operate in that kind of environment. And lastly, they developed a network. And it's this network that has still survived. And the reason why I call Taliban Al-Qaeda affiliated, because there have been several affiliations. I mean, why did Mullah Omar did not give up Osama bin Laden if there was no close affiliation? That was one element, but I do think there was a strong element in that regard. Second is that I really do believe that the Taliban have joined the global ideological jihad. If you look at the recent literature that is coming out, and if you analyze some of the videos, the Taliban are not talking about the Afghan struggle. The Taliban are very much comparing themselves like the insurgents in Iraq. This is what they're saying, that just like there's war in Fallujah, in a similar way, there's war in Qunar. So they have joined, you know, I guess when you look at the bigger picture. Another thing is that if there was no sort of affiliation, then I don't think the Taliban, that was such a conservative entity, would have resolved to these new methods. I think it's the fact that they have been infected in such a heavy, you know, way that they have carried out, whether these beheadings or whether these suicide attacks or even, you know, these improvised explosive devices, where are they coming from? Where did they learn this from? So that's one regard. Second thing, the Khad, the intelligence apparatus, has, I think, throughout the history, one of the most brutal organizations in my personal analytical point of view. I think when you look at the Russian invasion and subsequently the communist time, they were responsible for killing, I think, over 500,000 Afghans. And to be honest, I think it was one of the strongest institutions in Afghanistan, because I think the communist, one thing we have to do give them was that they were really good at organization, they were really good in dealing with those things, and they had established an organization that had control of the environment. If we look at the withdrawal of the Soviet Union, we see that many of the religious and even the organizations that were involved in jihad, they thought that they were going to conquer Kabul within a week or two. But it took them 3 years. It took them over 3 years. I mean, obviously, the Soviet Union was still providing assistance, but at the same time, I think it was these institutions that were still in place. Khad was still in place. You know, their police, in certain ways, was still in place. I think once the various groups took over, in certain ways, many of these institutions, I mean, the fabric of these institutions were really broken down. Especially when you look at the National Army. I mean, basically paralyzed, it was dissolved. So there was no such thing. They thought that this power vacuum could be replaced by, you know, militia or their own private soldiers. So a lot of the institutions that was really protected, you know, security in that regard, for whatever reason, for whatever the government may have come, I think many of them were really... you know, they do not have the same capacity as at one point they did. But now they're developing. Now I think is a stage for them to develop, because they have to stand on their own feet, and they have realized that. But I think it will take them time. When it comes to intelligence, you know, many people say that. Intelligence is an art form, and surely becoming an artist will take some time.
See this gentleman here.
Lee Baldwin, United Press International. Over the border in Kashmir recently, Islamists were able to step into the vacuum and provide aid where the state was unable to do so. Although the earthquake over there, and is there the possibility of a wider phenomenon where Islamist groups capitalize by providing welfare where the state cannot?
I've been following that situation actually, where certain of the radical groups have gone to a particular element and have provided aid and resources. Even very recently, the Al-Qaeda number 2 came out with a video which stated that regardless of what Pakistan is, their entity, their affiliation with the United States, we should do everything we can to support them. So it's a call in that way. But I think there's a strategy behind it. There's a very clear strategy, in my opinion, is that they're trying to motivate people. They're trying to gather support. They're trying to get the goodwill of the average population. And that, I think, is the key goal. Whatever side you look at, I think if we look at the broader situation, they don't want this fight to look like, you know, the West against a bunch of militants. That's not the goal. If you read Ayman al-Zawahiri's, you know, book, It's very clear that they have long-term objectives. These people are very smart. And they want this to seem like this is a clash of civilization. You know, Huntington's biggest fan, I think, is Osama bin Laden, because he wants the people to believe that that is the reality. And unfortunately, the reality is that we're helping them. Certain of our acts, certain of our, you know, maybe ignorances, certain of our issues that we, you know, deal with, provide them this political oxygen that proves their case, you know. But in Afghanistan, there hasn't been this element. I think there have been several cases where I think Taliban have taken over a particular district, but within the arrival of the Afghan army and the coalition forces, I think they run away, and it's not like they have heavy ground. You know, so this phenomenon has not happened in Afghanistan yet. So.
Let's take three more questions. Start there, go to this woman, and then to this gentleman here. Three more questions.
Hi, I'm John Kroc with Mercy Corps, who's very active in Afghanistan. I have a question about the U.S. approach. The Provisional Reconstruction Teams have been the predominant kind of evolution of the U.S. military's approach in Afghanistan. And as an NGO working also in Iraq, we're hearing a lot of talk from USAID and other people that they want that to be the approach for the insurgency in Iraq. Yeah. Comment on the success you think those have had, or if you think that is an approach that is viable in Afghanistan and later on in other countries.
Yeah. For those who are not familiar with the PRT's concept, it's military and civilian individuals going to particular areas and building infrastructure or building wells and other elements. In my personal opinion, I think the bottom line is to improve the livelihood of a particular area, to improve the conditions of the Afghans. Something needs to happen. Something needs to occur. And if the international community, i.e. the NGOs, are not able to do it, I think something has to take place. We cannot completely abandon the population. I mean, it's fine. I think when security is there, then the international community would go there and operate. But what about the people that are living there that have been, you know, in certain ways neglected while the Taliban were there, and now the Taliban are not there, you know, there as a government, they're still neglected because in certain ways they're either associated with the Taliban or, you know, I can't really find a flaw in their perspective. The PRTs, in my opinion, obviously it's a major conflict in terms of the NGOs and military conducting a civilian operation. Obviously, I see the clear conflict, but I think we should also look at the alternative side. Without the PRTs, these people have no option. There's no other alternatives. And I've seen the PRTs do some really remarkable work in certain areas. I mean, they're building schools, they're building wells, they're helping particular areas, which is all positive, which is, you know, this is building goodwill. This is developing on this positive relationship. But then we throw all that up by acting, you know, stupidly and childishly. You know, so recently there have been reports that they would like to carry out similar things in Iraq. So I'm not sure if it'll develop or not. So.
Monica Jervy from Transparency International. When you were giving your talk about prior to 9/11, you mentioned that there were, I think, 43 different al-Qaeda affiliates in Afghanistan at the time, training with al-Qaeda and whatnot. And then you said that they had come back, and that wasn't clear to me. I wanted to know what they're doing now and where.
When you look at the broader movement of how supposedly the jihad started, I think several elements have to be clearly understood. First, the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, and then the revolution in Iran, which also had a huge impact on this. First, I think the Russian invasion of Afghanistan brought this amazing cry
for this defense against the infidels, for the Muslims to rise, and especially when you look at the whole concept of jihad, between offensive jihad and defensive jihad and the distinction of it. And this calls for this defensive jihad were raised. Many of the Muslims from all over the world came and participated in this jihad against the Russians. Even though, in my opinion, I may be biased, but I think all the fighting was done by the Afghans. You don't take pleasure from the Afghans in that regard. So, but I think the credits were given a lot to a lot of these Arabs in that regard. Well, you know, so many of the groups that came and fought stayed there. Upon the Russian withdrawal, the traditional or the Mujahideen that were there to fight the Russians, they left, they went back. Certain of them stayed to continue on battling. And this is where some of the conflict emerges between Abdullah Azam and Osama bin Laden, because they had different approaches in terms of how to carry this jihad. Do they continue to fight in Afghanistan or do they go abroad? Many of the groups that came and trained went back to their own countries and they started their own movements. And in many of these movements, groups like, you know, Abu Sayyaf group, groups like JI, where from JI, you know, you had individuals like Abu Bakr Bashir and Abdullah Sankar, they came and they established this organization, then they tried to carry out this jihad outside. But at the same time, what happened is they failed miserably. They weren't able to carry on. So once Osama bin Laden comes back, he goes obviously to Saudi Arabia, and then from there Sudan. When he comes back, he establishes these network, he establishes these camps all over again. And then you see this almost the next generation, the same affiliations, the same group that had come in the early 80s came back. But by this time, Al-Qaeda had really developed and matured as an entity, as an organization, and stronger ties were really established with these groups. So this is why when you look at Al-Qaeda, it's not just one Al-Qaeda today. We face 20 to 30 Al-Qaedas today, because all of them try to imitate and emulate and mount attacks like Al-Qaeda. So there were two various groups that came to Afghanistan, and they were trained, they were indoctrinated. They're all operating. Most of them are, where do you think these attacks are coming from? The attacks that are taking place, whether it's in Sharm el-Sheikh or whether it's in Rabat, whether it's in Algeria, whether it's anywhere. In certain regards, those are the groups that came to Afghanistan and they were trained. The other phenomenon that has taken place in this post 9/11 world is that we see groups that have absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. We see this in London and we see this in Madrid. There's no direct affiliation or association with Al-Qaeda, but these are groups, they want to exactly be like Al-Qaeda. So this is this new trend of how the threat in certain ways has changed, and the threat is more diffused now.
Last question.
Chris Schaefer, CNO Resources, Sanam Hekmat, welcome back. I have a question about priorities and constraints. One, I know you're talking a lot about the fluidity of the insurgency and the Taliban, so it's an evolving creature. Conventional wisdom is that an insurgency takes upwards of 9 years to defeat, and I know CSIS, among other things, has called for sort of a 10-year or more than 10-year commitment as being one of their recommendations. But one of the tensions we're having is competing priorities, and there was a survey in the quoted by the Center for American Progress that said Americans, one survey quoting Americans, that out of 30 national security priorities, they had ranked Afghanistan dead last. And what I'm wondering is, as we look towards the sort of post or the Kabul agenda next year, what are reasonable expectations of the U.S. or the international community, and how do we prioritize the things that you've outlined in terms of defeating the insurgents or terrorists?
Thanks. I think it's important to look at Afghanistan it's in its current context, that it's a state that has not fully recovered, that does not really have institutions, that is able to, in certain ways, defend itself.
that is able to provide for its population, especially if you look at their regional, not only regional, their local governance. In certain ways, it's not at that standard. And I think that will take time. But at the same time, I think there are elements of corruption that has been introduced in certain ways. There are other elements that I think, you know, we should be worried about. But at the same thing, the international community cannot abandon Afghanistan at this crucial stage, especially while it's going through this process. Afghanistan, I think, in my opinion, in the last four stages has made remarkable strides, whether they're political or in terms of creating institutions. They're not at that stage where they're, you know, where their own alone, their own abilities will suffice. The concentration really needs to occur on several things. First, as I mentioned, improving the Afghan livelihood, and that can be done in many ways, economic incentives, creating a free market society, where the free market is the engine of growth for the society, which is a key element which should be concentrated on. I think we're not utilizing the Afghan skills and their potentials to do well in the several markets. So there's a lot of things the Afghans can actually produce that I think we're not doing at this stage, whether it's fruits, whether it's, you know, minerals, a lot of these things. In another way, you can't really blame those elements because in Afghanistan, you don't really have the capacity. Like, there's several minerals in Afghanistan that would the Afghans would be able to produce, but at the same time, they really do not understand the market as to where is it that they will be able to sell this. You know, who is it that they would demand this product? You know, so I think the international community really does need to pay closer attention to Afghanistan because we have seen what happens to Afghanistan when the international community neglects it, and we're starting to see it again in certain ways. So granted, Iraq has gathered a lot of attention, it does not mean that we should abandon Afghanistan. Thank you.
Hikmah, thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to Morgan, Courtney, and to John Radcliffe for helping to put on this event and for the other work they've done in Afghanistan. Thanks again.